The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Strong jobs boost markets. More executive orders out of Washington. Spending and consumer confidence stay up, and our guest today, Frank Curzio from Curzio Research and frankcurzio.com. All this and much more on episode number 495 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Here we are, Super Bowl Sunday. Pretty excited about that. This is Andrew Horowitz, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. You can find out more of what we're talking about and get more information about the show, of course, on the show notes over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But yeah, we have Super Bowl Sunday here. Falcons and Patriots are going to square off tonight. Pretty exciting. But we have some things to take care of before that. Got to talk about the markets. Got to talk about what's happening with the economy. Have to understand more about what's going on with our investments and see if there's some opportunities. And we're going to talk about some of those today, probably in depth when we get to our guest, Frank Curzio. He hasn't been on for some time, so I thought I'd bring him back. And, you know, we talk all the time, and he's got some great ideas. So definitely going to be a good interview, I'm sure of that. Now, what's going on around the world? We have a lot of, I think, confusion and complacency that are mixed into one. I'm not sure what that word would actually be if we could merge them, but you have this situation where there is a lot of concern about some of the policies that are coming out. Clearly, we've seen just a barrage of executive orders and commentary out of Washington. And there's going to be some, you know, back and forth on that probably. And there's going to be some more coming, I'm certain, and how the reaction to those plays out within markets right now. I know that taxes and, you know, some of the regulatory environment that's been so overbearing for small businesses is talked about being repealed. And that's all good. So we'll see how this all plays out in terms of markets moving forward, in particular as earnings season starts to get towards the end. We're about three quarters of the way through it right now, but a lot of companies are coming out, and we'll see what their outlook is going to be. Let's kind of give a quick review of what happened last week and what we have to look forward to the coming week. We saw that a jobs report on Friday boosted markets. We had 227,000 new job hires. Now, wage growth was the big sticky factor. The concern that we saw and why the markets acted kind of weird. We saw gold go up a bit. We saw the bonds being bought, but markets went up too. Now, it was not only just that everybody was buying everything, which it looked like from the outside, but I think this whole idea that wage growth only moved up by 0.1% in January was concerning. We had a 4.8% jobless rate. The U6 rate rose to 9.4%. That's the underemployed and the unemployed. And it was a good report overall. There's no question about that, seeing that we had 227,000 net new hires on. Okay, that's good. Industries overall pretty much were well represented, and I think that was good. The jobless rate going from 4.8%, and if it moves to 4.9, to 4.7, to 4.6, that's not as big of a concern of mine at all. But still, there is this concern, I think, on the street that wage growth is just not increasing very much. Now, at the same time, consumer confidence was a little bit lower in January, about 1.5% lower from the official conference board's monthly consumer confidence index. But it's still above, 118 or right out, 111. 111 right now. Still well above that. So that's good. Personal spending, interestingly enough, without the wage growth, increased 0.5% in December. Personal income was up 0.3%. So I think the personal spending issue probably had a lot to do with the holidays. And there was some excess spending after a good year. So that may be a one-off there. So if we combine all the issues that personal income was up 0.3%. We saw that wage growth is only 0.1%. I don't think that this personal spending is going to continue to show very strong numbers moving forward. Doesn't seem logical. In terms of what happened on the manufacturing front, this was interesting. In terms of we're seeing that still the factory index is now at 56. That's good. The service sector stayed about flat at about 56.5. But that factory sector where we have that demarcation of 50, below 50 is contraction and above 50 is expansion, is continuing to hold strong. 56 is a very good number. And when you look at all the economics, you have to put all these things into a pot, mix it around and see what it all looks like in a big picture. You got to see GDP. You got to see factory growth on a total. You got to look at the individual areas, the Philly Fed, Kansas City, reports in terms of what they're putting out for, and then the New York, and you have to see the different regionals, and you got to see the Beige Book and all these things. When you look at these together, you have to say, what is the economy doing now? And what has it done looking backwards? And what do we see moving forward? For the moment, clearly it looks like everything is just fine. And I'm saying that seriously, there is really nothing, there's no real cracks. Everything is just plodding along. People are spending, not too much, not too little. It doesn't look like there's any problem with the employment. Factories are doing their thing. Inventories are okay. GDP is hanging in there. There's nothing really out there from an economic standpoint at this point that looks like it's either going to overshoot to the upside or slow down precipitously in the near future. There's just nothing out there that's showing this. I mean, there's just nothing. Now, looking at the market at the end of the week, we saw that the S&P rose about 0.12% for the most part during the week. In the beginning of the week, it was not doing too well. It looked like there was going to be a real slowdown and a pretty good down week until Friday when markets rallied pretty nicely. NASDAQ was up 0.1. The Dow was down 0.1%. So really not much movement overall. Again, nothing to be concerned about. A lot of earnings coming out next week. We have Disney, Vulcan Materials in the cement area. A lot of biotechs, Allergan's coming out, Glaxo's coming out. We're going to see some healthcare also related to Humana. We're going to see Whole Foods, which is going to be interesting to see. Coca-Cola is going to be coming out. Cummins, Beezer, Holmes, Kellogg, Kemper, Occidental Petroleum, Pandora, Skechers, Twitter. Skechers, I put a big question mark on, by the way. Watch that. Twitter is going to be interesting to see. There's been, once again, a flurry of under-the-radar commentary about Twitter being bought or somebody coming after Twitter. You're starting to see that, and that's why the stock is perking up again. So keep an eye on that. And then we have, there's really not a lot of economic news this week. So that's good. And the Fed speakers have seemingly gone away. Have you noticed this? I don't know what's happened this year, but like the Fed is, you know, a couple of here and there scheduled, but the parade has stopped. Thank God. I mean, this is just, it was too much. There was too much Fed speakers trying to drive the market this way or that way. Now, whether they are hibernating or whether they're just doing a wait and see attitude or whether they realize that, you know what, people have had enough of us already. I, for one, have had enough of the Fed. Fed up with the Fed. It's enough. Let the markets do the thing. And if you remember our thesis way back when, that we wrote about this in a quarterly commentary that we sent to our clients and we have available. As a matter of fact, on a couple of the areas on, I'll put up this last economic commentary. If you want to grab our last economic commentary, I'll put it in the show notes of the show on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. So just click on the show from the show and there'll be a little area there to download the form or download the quarterly commentary. But one of the things we talked about some time ago was the velocity of money. And there was just no velocity. The money was just not flowing through the system. Now, some people blame it on the banking industry, how the banking industry has not done loans. But there's a lot more and a lot more to it than just getting loans and borrowing money to pay for things. There's the whole notion of consumers. There's a whole notion of money just forcing its way through the system or getting clogged somewhere. And of course, credit has something to do with it, but not all. And one of the things that I had talked about and said, just raise rates or have the idea that rates will be moving higher in the future. We've never seen the velocity of money start to really pick up when there's been a very low interest rate environment. It just hasn't happened. And one of the reasons is that it's deflationary. The natural mechanism of low interest rates that are going to stay low for an extended period of time is deflationary. Now, I don't know why the Fed hasn't seen this before, but notice, as we have seen that interest rates, or at least the idea that interest rates will start moving up and inflation would start climbing, all of a sudden things are getting a little bit better. A little bit more buying going on, spending going on. Why? People get off the fence. You know how this is, right? You're not going to do anything unless you're forced to do something. I'm not going to just simply renew my insurance unless there's something either wrong with it or it's time to renew it. In the middle of the year, I'm not going to do anything. If I think that there's going to be a reduction in the price of a car that will stay on for some time and really won't change, not going to go higher, I'm not going to be, there's going to be no incentive for me to go do that. If housing prices are maintaining where they are, they're not really moving, well, I'm not going to be forced and at least feel forced that I'm going to have to go buy something right now, because if I don't, prices are going to run away from me. Now, as prices have started to move higher, what does that do? It naturally moves prices higher even further and gets people off their keisters to go do something. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that interest rates, while they are a drag on the economy, if they move up too much, we're at such a low level right now that it's not going to have that much effect on the economy. And you can see that by the couple of interest rate rises that recently happened have had no effect on the economy, no effect on consumer confidence, no effect on spending, no effect on credit. So this notion that you have to keep interest rates low is preposterous. It's just ridiculous. You want to move it up, and you want to move it up to a point where people feel that they're forced to do something. That may seem terrible, but that's a natural process of the economic cycle. So keep that in mind when you look at where interest rates are and where they've been and how they're going to play out over time. A couple other things I'll mention to you. I mentioned that DH Unplugged is in fact streaming live on Tuesday evenings at 9 p.m. Go over to DH Unplugged to listen to myself and John C. Dvorak talk about some crazy things and some stock tips, as well as a couple of games we played, like Closest to the Pin and the old Codgers versus the Millennials. And it's all related to stocks. It's all related to what's going on right now. I think you could still join. There is a Close to the Pin competition going on right now where you can guess the price of Amazon sometime in the future that we lay out for you over there, and you can win a t-shirt, and there's some great things going on. You have to check out these things over on dhunplugged.com. Okay, we got that out of the way. The other things I'll mention, of course, before we get to Frank for just a second, I've gotten a lot of emails recently. And I think because there is this changing tide in terms of investors of what they're thinking is going to be happening with the markets in terms of volatility, in terms of uncertainty. And a lot of just the last couple of weeks have been a tremendous amount of people that have requested information on the TDI Managed Growth Strategy, which we have a brand new. Out only a month or so. If you haven't seen it, over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, I'll put a link on this as well. You go over to the virtual tour to see what's going on with the managed growth strategy, where we invest money, very much like what we talk about here. Many of the stocks, we use a Quantafunda Techna strategy, which is screening and then looking at the fundamentals and then looking at the technicals for entries, exit points on one core area. We have a core area of fundamentals. We have Arrow embedded in there. There's a lot of things that are going on in there. That may change because we also change with the times. We do some hedging in that portfolio. We go short. We will use options. And then you could check that out. There's also the Arrow strategy and a few other things to check out over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. That's my plug for the day. So if you like the things that we talk about here, if you're concerned about your portfolio, if you've been sitting on it saying, just let it ride, but now you're starting to get a little concerned that, well, maybe, things are going to be changing here. Doesn't mean go down, but the sectors change and strategy changes and the way to diversify a portfolio changes. Maybe it's time. Go check it out on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Well, with that, how about we just get right to it with our guest for the show? And, he hasn't been on for some time. As a matter of fact, last time was for a full interview was back in September, mid-September. And now he made some time for us actually doing some research out there in the field. We have Frank Curzio from Curzio Research. You can find all the information about what Frank is doing and what he's up to over on frankcurzio.com. So, Frank, how are you?
Good. Thanks for inviting me back on the podcast, bud. Appreciate it.
Yeah, well, always no invitation needed. So let's talk about, I know you're busy doing some research and things are happening, but let me just kind of catch everybody up from where we were. So we were, last we talked, which I kind of was amazed that it was actually back in September. I thought it was like, wow. I thought it was last month. Well, we talk all the time, but I thought it was like last month you were on. Anyway, I look back, you know, as I always do to see, hey, what was Frank talking about back then? What kind of stocks, what things, the markets and all that. And so you had three or four different things that you liked a lot. And actually, they've done pretty well. There was a major up on one of them. You talk about GE. You really loved GE back then. Remember that? We talked about GE, industrials and all that. GE, you talked about it. It was about 29 bucks when you were talking about it. It's 29 now, went up to a 32. Hasn't done a lot, but still, I mean, good quality company. You talked about GSV. Gold stock.
Gold Standard Ventures.
Yep, it was at 226. It's now 284. That's had a big run over time. You talked about AT&T, which you liked a lot, which was about 41. So, I mean, you know, we've seen a lot of stocks do this where there's a big run up, towards the end of the year after the election. And then many of the big names kind of started saying, hey, wait a minute, maybe things aren't that good. We'll see. Let's talk about gold for a second, because I know that's something you've been tracking a lot and you've been talking about. And there's a few other things I want to talk about. But, you know, in terms of gold, gold has been, I don't know, it's been okay, but it's been at the same time not that exciting recently, because we've been seeing that, there's been this whole move towards risk on and risk assets. And gold has been definitely holding, but it's, I don't know, what's your thoughts on it?
You know, I just went to the Vancouver Investment Conference 2 weeks ago, and this is a conference I've been to a lot, and I've been traveling to, you know, the best mining conferences usually in Canada, right? And it's amazing what a difference 1 year makes. Because last year we went there, the market was horrible, everyone, you know, tail between their legs. This year, I mean, some of these stocks compared to, if you take like the last, like a full year, I mean, you're seeing even the junior miner index or the gold juniors are up over 100%. That's the index. So you're seeing a lot of these names up 200-300%. And when I went to this show, there was nobody that was bearish. Zero. I'm not even talking about one guy in the corner saying, well, no. I was the only one that got up there and said, guys, you got to be careful. You have 200-300% gains. I know it's coming off one of the worst times ever, a four-year period in a cycle that was one of the worst in 30 years, according to the people who have been in the industry that long. And when you see what's going on with gold right now, I think you have to be careful. There's one constant, right? We hear all the time, Andrew, what drives gold? People say inflation, it's deflation, it's a safe haven. But if, you know, and I ran the numbers and did the data and looked back, if you look at those three things, there's periods where gold has performed great during inflationary times and, you know, during the 70s, and there's periods where in the 80s to 2000 when it hasn't worked. Inflation, when you had inflation, it just didn't work. Is it a safe haven? It was during Brexit. But it wasn't really when Trump got elected, which everyone thought gold would soar. What happened? It soared initially, then really came down. But the one constant that you can look at for the gold and the driver is the dollar, at least since 2014. Don't even look at real interest rates. It's the dollar. So it's an inverse relationship. So the dollar goes higher, gold's going to go lower, and vice versa. Now, right now, with so many of Trump's policies coming out, we're seeing earnings coming out with probably 70% of the S&P 500 reported, and we're looking at 7-8% earnings growth, which is a huge number, as you know, Andrew, compared to what we've seen over the past 6 or 7 quarters, right?
Right.
You have Trump deregulation. I'm not going to get into politics here, because everybody fights when they talk about politics these days. But most of his policies and even the tax reforms, even the repeal of Dodd-Frank, these are going to be drivers of growth and probably have inflation going forward. When we see inflation, we're probably going to see a rising dollar at least over the next 6 months. So I'm a little bearish on gold. I'm telling people to take profits, and there'll probably be a better opportunity for you to jump into a lot of those names. But be careful, because if people ask you about gold, you should ask yourself, where do you think the dollar's going? Because if you have a better direction of the dollar and say, well, you know, there's pro-growth policies right now, it looks like inflation. If you look at the numbers, we definitely have a little bit of inflation. It looks as if the dollar is going to go higher at least over the next 6 months. If that happens, gold prices are going to come down, which means gold's prices are probably going to get hurt. And until that relationship breaks away from each other.
Right, but that's in dollar terms, right? So there's actually, I don't know if you saw this, but You know, GLD is the number one ETF holding of for gold. That's what people buy when they don't go after the actual the actual commodity themselves. They buy the ETF. There's other ways to do it too, but a lot of people use GLD for that. Uh-huh. I think they just came out with, I think it's called, don't quote me exactly on this, but I think it's GLDW, and that is a dollar hedged gold ETF.
Yes.
So the question is going to be, does gold go up on its own without, and you know, what happens to gold if the dollar is taken out of the equation? That's an interesting question, right?
And it's good because it's been a raging bull market in other currencies, right? I mean, you make a good point. But for me, when I see investors and regular investors, right? Because when you get sophisticated and you have people where they can use option strategies, they can use currency hedges, gold has been unbelievable it's for Australia and other currencies. But when you really talk about the dollar, which most people, I believe that I talk to and my listeners on our podcast, when they're buying gold, they're buying GLD. But it's great that you brought that up. It is a great point. The fact that now they have an ETF makes me a little bit worried.
Well, no kidding.
ETFs always get traded
right
at the top of the market, yeah, right? The best ETFs. So
right.
They're not going to launch any. Listen, guys. If you see a new ETF, they're not going to launch an ETF on a sector that's terrible because they need demand. They need people to buy it. So they usually launch ETFs on, you know, the most excitement possible. And usually you'll see like every ETF, if you bunch it up, it's usually a huge downtrend the first few years. So just be careful on that.
You know, it's interesting also that when we look at let's talk about gold miners. So there's gold miners throughout the world. Right. There's gold miners in the U.S. There's gold miners in Canada. Just those two, just to talk about that, those areas. Is there a difference in how the companies that are gold miners in the different countries react to the dollar? So I would make the assumption that gold miners in the U.S., as the dollar goes higher, are affected much more to a degree when the dollar goes higher. But what about when the Canadian loonie goes lower?
That's the thing. I mean, so if you're a miner operating in Canada, your costs are going lower, have lowered tremendously. I mean, that's the big offset for some of the Canadian. That's why they're still okay. It hasn't been a total disaster, especially during the downturn, because you saw the Canadian currency, where that came down, dollar rose tremendously. But a lot of their costs are priced, or they're not priced in dollars. So they're able to keep their costs down. And the costs, I mean, it's the most capital intensive business when it comes to mining, right? If you're buying a junior miner, they basically put a stake in the ground, they'll drill holes. Even that's expensive. But to actually develop a mine, I mean, the costs associated are insane. So when you can keep those costs down, it's not just infrastructure, water, you know, roads, it's tires. So many of your costs, it's amazing how many millions of dollars, when you cut your costs by 20-30% of what we've seen with the Canadian currency, decline against the dollar in what, the last 2 years, 2.5 years, maybe a little longer. That's one benefit that they actually have, but still you would like to see gold prices go higher as well.
Right.
Because that's a driver. That's ultimately the driver of the stock.
But you know, the other thing though is, and by the way, folks, Frank is coming to us on a phone call, and usually we do them through a direct connection. So if you need to push your slow down button as he's talking, because he talks very, very fast. Faster than I talk, I think. And what happens is now with his phone, it's a little bit. So, Frank, you can slow down a little bit. I know you get excited when we talk about gold and things like this, but.
I don't know. I do. Even my presentations, man, I guess I try to get as much in as possible because I'm only on your podcast. Now I'm only on like once every 6 months. Used to be like every 3 months. What's going on, man?
You know, Frank.
I want to get everything in possible.
Right. When they say Frank's going to give a 2-hour presentation in 1 hour.
There you go.
Okay, but let's just...
They could slow it down on the podcast and make it faster, so that's okay.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about something. Let's talk about markets. I want to bring this back to the idea of commodities and metals, et cetera, but the markets, the general consensus of markets. One of the things we know historically is that markets generally don't like uncertainty. Uncertainty is also very good oftentimes for safety plays like bonds or metals, and et cetera. There is, there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty right now going on around the world with the issues with outside the U.S. in terms of France, in terms of Italy, possibly leaving the Eurozone, and of course, Brexit. We have what's going on in Iran, the Middle East right now. We have the situation with nuclear North Korea. We have China kind of, doing better. We have the negative rate still in Japan. There's the Trump presidency. In terms of the actions he's taken. A lot of uncertainty out there, right? A lot of uncertainty out there. But why are markets discounting all of this?
Because I think the U.S. is great. That's why. Because there's so many drivers of the U.S. right now. And listen, I mean, we're right now, we're in one of the longest bull markets. I think it's second barely, but I think if it goes three more months, it's going to be the longest bull market in terms of duration in history since, you know, in the history of our country. So for me, even 6 months ago, 9 months ago, I'm like, hey, guys, take some off the table. I didn't think Trump was going to run. Even when Trump won, it was the uncertainty that I was worried about. But he has so many pro-growth policies. Where, and again, put the politics aside, okay, because it's going to lose your money if you're arguing whether you believe in Trump. Or, you know, we're not talking about immigration policies or anything. What we're talking about is what's going to happen is we're going to get tax reforms. You're looking at repatriation of, you know, think of a company like Apple who just reported earnings. They have $246 billion in cash. So in cash, so, I mean, that's a bigger market cap than Pfizer. You know, that's
I think it's one-fifth of all the S&P cash is with Apple.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And 90% of that is overseas. So think about if they have a tax rate instead of paying ordinary tax or whatever they're going to pay, if it's 39%, if it's 30, they want to bring it back at 10 to 20%. If they could do that for Apple, you're talking about a massive amount of money, not just for Apple, but most of the companies that have the biggest cash hoards overseas are pharmaceuticals and technology companies. Also, just lowering the tax rates. Like you saw Chipotle come out with weak earnings, but, you know, same store sales were very good. You know, they're positive for the first time. So you saw the stock. Everyone thought it was going to drop. Everyone was negative, especially on CNBC. It went up. The reason why, I think, is because they have one of the highest tax rates at 39%. And if they get that percent to 25, I mean, you're talking about an increase, and I've done studies on this, of earnings growth of 10 to 12%. Now, if you're looking at 10 to 12% earnings growth, you know the numbers as well as I do. I don't know if everyone listening does, but we didn't grow earnings for seven straight quarters before, what, 2 quarters ago, I think. And this quarter, we're going to see earnings growth. We had negative year-over-year earnings. And just by a simple tax rate, you could increase your earnings by double digits. Now, you're looking at all the tax reforms where the banks are sitting, you know, they're in some of the strongest positions ever because they have to keep a massive amount of capital because of these laws on their books. Now that those laws can be changed, and it's not going to be a total repeal of Dodd-Frank, but you're going to see less regulation, which means they could be a little bit more aggressive. I know people are very fearful of what happened, and they think, you know, oh, here we go again, and we're going to go back to the whole housing crisis, which started, you know, whatever you could debate it, but the whole housing crisis. But there's a big medium there where it doesn't have to be so much over-regulation or no regulation. So they're going to dial back on the regulation, which means more money's going to enter the system, more loans coming in. So there's a lot of pro-growth policies that are very good for the U.S. in the next 6 to 12 months. You're seeing inflation come into the market too, which is what the Fed's been trying to do for 10 years and they haven't been able to do it. Now we're starting to see it. These are all very, very good signs of a market that's much better than everybody else. So I think that's why you're seeing, like, even money come into the market where there's so much uncertainty, and you didn't even mention China. Like you said, North Korea, Iran, Europe, with Brexit in Italy, where I think people think the U.S. is the safe haven, and that's why you're not really seeing the markets in the U.S. really come down, because I think people are more optimistic than they've ever been.
Last week, I talked about this whole issue of the tax reform or tax cuts or tax benefits and what's going on. I actually ran a screen. I should send this to you. I don't know if I sent this to you, but I put it up on, I think we put it up on, I talked about it, and I think we made it available for listeners, and I'll check on that though. But I ran a screen, and I looked at companies out there and their effective tax rate. I want to see companies that had reasonable volume. I want to see that they had continuing EPS growth over the last several quarters and in year over year, revenue growth as well, and a reasonable, I think, a $5 billion market cap. And I got a list of, I don't know, maybe 90 stocks that had met the basic criteria. But if you look down the list, you know, you look at the effective tax rate. Effective tax rate, for example, for Aetna, 43%. United Healthcare, 39%. Amazon, 39%. Whole Foods, 38%. CarMax, 30%. I'm just kind of randomly picking these, 37%. You go down this list, I mean, the first page is probably 50 different companies, all above 36%. Now, if you take that down to even 35%, even 30%, even 25%, what you're going to have is incredible amount of margin expansion. And that's immediate, right? There's no question. It's just immediate margin expansion.
Yeah.
And therefore, companies are going to be able to keep more profits, even if they have the same revenues that they've had over time, and that's going to boost the earnings and net profit of the company, thereby allowing for PE multiple to be put on there and expand. That's a lot of what's going on here. The big question, though, is when? So even if they implement a tax reform now, I'm not even talking about, by the way, personal taxes. I'm talking about just corporate taxes here. So on a corporate tax basis, if they implement it, let's say, I don't know, next month or the month after or 3 months from now, is it going to be for 2018 taxes or 2017? I'm pretty sure they'll try to push it to be retroactive for 2017.
Well, it's interesting. That's a great point because people believe, and that was one of my fears too, that every one of his policies are going to happen immediately. And his priority right now is, out of all the major things that he's looking to take care of when you look at tax reforms and everything, is and deregulation, is Obamacare. So the form of healthcare, I think he should wait on that, even though, you know, for me, I think it's a total disaster. It's not political, but I have my own business now with Curzio Research, and my healthcare expenses are more than my mortgage, and they're going up 20% this year and 15-20% next year. So that something has to be done for in that regards. But there's so many moving parts and they don't even have a plan in place. I would focus more on the tax reforms first, because if you look back at when's the last time, we always look back at history, just like you said, you running screens and stuff. When's the last time we've seen something like this? It was the Reagan administration, and he was running on tax reforms. And few people know that before those tax reforms, he was in for two terms. Before they got passed was his fifth year. So we went four full years without getting those tax reforms, without them finally being put into the market. And the market right now is pricing in like it's going to happen tomorrow. And that scares me a little bit, to be honest.
The market's been pricing in that everything. I talked about this in recently on the disciplinedinvestor.com. I said, the market is not looking at the glass as half full, three quarters full. It's looking at it topped off to the brim, where we're going to have all these things happening immediately.
Yes. And this is normal for markets, right? They don't move on news. They move in anticipation on news and usually sell off when the news is actually reported, right? So the markets are always looking ahead, what's going to happen ahead. But they may be looking at right now, and when I say the markets, a lot of institutions and people, pushing money into the right sectors, right, to benefit from these reforms coming later on. It seems like they believe that they're going to happen a lot sooner, and they could take a year, 2 years, maybe 3 years to take place, even with, the fact that they have, full control over the House and the Senate. But it's going to be interesting to see when this passes. But as time goes on, we're going to see that premium come down a lot. If we think it's going to be pushed out for 6 months, 9 months, a year, you're going to see the market come down off it, because it's, like you said, it's priced in. Like, it's definitely going to happen very, very soon.
Well, especially when you see, if you see, that people are expecting this all to be all, rosy. And then what happens is we start to see companies coming in with an outlook, and they're not taking in consideration and being very bullish on the outlook in terms of taxes, and then saying, hey, here's our earnings, here's our revenue. Well, the next few months we don't see things going as well. And then they just obliterate the stocks because they've run up so dramatically into expectations. And we saw that a little bit. We saw, some of that. This quarter, that there's been some on the latter half of this earnings season, that some companies are getting hit a little bit, because now it's like, wait a second, maybe this isn't going to happen so fast. But in terms of it's very funny, Frank. You've twice or three times now mentioned, I don't want to be political. Boy, people are scared of talking about politics these days. I always set the stage when I talk about the different policies that, listen, let's get it straight. This isn't political, because, once you start going, oh, I don't like it, or I do like it, or, in terms of giving an opinion on the quote unquote political side, the emails don't stop. Right?
This is the world we live in right now. Right. It's like, for instance, if I'm talking about anything, even when it comes to racial or whatever, and if everyone's making a point, they make it a point first. I'm not racial. I have, African-American friends. They have to justify it before they come up with a point. That's the world we live in. But, for now, it's we're in a world where, you could protest whatever. Like, everybody's mad. Everybody's angry. You can protest whatever you want.
People are angry.
And it's just, for me, it feels like, they compare it. Well, what would happen if people didn't march, like back in the day, with civil rights and equality and voting and stuff like that? And, those problems already existed when people were marching. Those are major problems. Right now, I think people are marching for problems that they think are going to exist. So why don't we, wait a little bit, see what happens, because, even when it comes to the EPA, and I've had, so many different experiences with the EPA. That's one of the most important organizations in the world, you know, but it's also one of the most corrupt in the world. It's used as a political tool to just go after people. And once they're on you, you shut down your business and they won't even look at the facts. I mean, it's such a corrupt organization. And I think that's why, you know, the Republicans and also the Democrats, this has nothing to do with, you know, we either side, but they don't understand why Donald Trump got elected. I think people just want that change where we're sick of all the political talk, for where Nancy Pelosi's right after they announced the Supreme Court pick, half an hour later, she does a town hall and she had a list of probably 20 names that it could have been. And she's going to destroy any name that the Republicans said. You know, it's just, it's all set up where I think both sides don't understand, you know, what's going on, how, you know, people hate this. And for the EPA, it's not a Democrat or Republican thing because it was corrupt before Obama. You know, so
I understand. The whole notion of politics has been very divisive. It has been very, it's divided the, you know, people along many different lines. And unfortunately, I think that sometimes people can't look beyond the politics to make a rational mm-hmm. and logical opinion or decision about something. And that's where the problems come in, by the way. That's where the big problems come
and
in.
And it was never, even the people that I talk to who, you know, have been in politics for such a long time and unfortunate to have great friends in that area, they've never seen it this bad. Like, for instance, you know, I'm a Republican. I hate the Affordable Health Care Act. I don't hate Obama. I know that he has a love for the country. I think he did a pretty good job as president. I just don't agree with all of his policies, but I don't hate the guy. I know, you know, it's like there's a level of hate. Instead of disagreeing to try and get to the point and make it better, there's such hate out there where it's like, you know, if you disagree with somebody, that's it. They hate you forever.
Well,
you know,
especially like, a lot of those people that are spewing a lot of the hatred are all about not wanting to have hatred, right?
Yeah, right. It's so crazy. We're in a country that's founded on disagree. We disagree to come up with good conclusions. That's fine.
It's important. Yeah,
this is what
I
we
agree.
Want to do. I mean, yeah.
I agree that disagreement is very healthy, and I do agree the debate is very healthy. I do. I mean, I'm not mm-hmm. really in favor of the new executive action process, but that's a different discussion entirely.
No.
I mean, I think there needs to be the three cornerstone areas of our government playing together somehow. Now you say, well, they can't. Mm-hmm. That's a different story. Let's switch over before this gets really bad emails coming in. Let's talk about something.
We need to address it, though, because it has a lot of influence in stocks.
That's the point.
We have to, as analysts, do. It's not like, hey, we take it, so we'll have opinions about it. But it's just, you know, like I think we both agree it would be better if we just got along and we get it. But we have to address it because it has a major influence on stocks.
That's the point, by the way. At the end of the day, when we talk about the policies, it's all about the policies and how we're going to invest, make money or not lose money on the policies. That's the whole point of our show, right? It's all about education, about information, and what's going to happen with that. All right, let's talk about some of the time we have left. So we know there's uncertainty with the markets. We know that there's things going on. I know that you and I, interestingly enough, recently came up with the conclusion that there was an opportunity out there, independently, by the way, and not even talking to each other about this, almost at the same time. Well, you may have been a little bit earlier, but I didn't know about it per se. And you were really talking about these uranium stocks, which is like something like uranium. Uh-huh. People, uranium stocks? What the hell? What's going on there? Now, I looked at it from a couple different angles. I looked at some charts. I looked at some of the long-term, you know, 6 or 7 year malaise that it's been in for some time. These companies have been horrible. I also looked at some of the recent rhetoric about nuclear war, the potential for getting back, or nuclear armament, I should say, the idea that we may be getting back to nuclear power, which has been, you know, somewhat pushed down the ranks when we had solar and, you know, hydro and all the different types and wind power. Tell me a little bit about your thesis on uranium and uranium stocks.
Yes. And fair disclosure here, I thought uranium was a screaming buy about 12 months ago, and I stopped out of a couple different stocks. But re-entered a lot of those positions. Remember, when looking at uranium, we're looking at commodities, they're cyclical markets. And even in gold, which is why I was incredibly bullish. And again, a little early to that, but it worked out tremendously for my subscribers. We're looking at a market that's never been this bad in almost the history of uranium. So since Fukushima, it's been almost a steady downtrend since 2010, 2011. And you know, there hasn't really been too many fundamental changes. And prices came down. They were well over 100 and they went to 30. And people like how cheap they are. They went to 25. And something amazing happened. They went below 20. The fact that they went below 20, you would compare that almost twice as worse from the period of, I would say, January 2009 to the bottom of the market in 2009. Because a lot of people at the end of 2008 came out and they were right. They said, this is a time to buy the market. It's one of the best opportunities. And you saw the S&P 500 declined another 30% from January to March, right? Now, if we take today, they were right, right? But that 30% decline was just unbelievable, overshot, incredibly on the downside to 666 before, you know, and everybody was over 2,000 now for the S&P. When you look at your rating, when prices fell below 20, it was the first time that I could remember, maybe in history, that not one mine is economical. Not one company can produce uranium and make money from it. That's why Cameco came out. They won this. For some reason, I thought, you know, the stock fell 20% of that news before coming back. I don't know why that was news. Anyone covering the uranium industry, they had to shut down mines. They had to cut their workforce because they're a producer. There's other uranium companies that aren't producing, have huge deposits, but they're not going to be influenced as much as the price when it comes in terms of profits, because Cameco and Areva, these guys are actually producing and making money, and that those profits have gone down tremendously. But now you have Kazakhstan, which is the OPEC of the uranium industry, cutting production by 10%. Nobody can make money off of uranium right now, right, by mining it. So almost all the mines are shut down. It's a complete change in the fundamental landscape of the industry when that happens. When nobody, so you're going to see a massive amount of supply come off, almost like we saw with oil when it went down below 30. And then you saw what? There's like 75 companies around in the U.S. that went bankrupt. Mm-hmm. We saw it. So at that price level, it's a game changer. It had to go higher. Right now, we're seeing what, 25, 30% move in uranium prices in not even that long, but in the past few months. But you're looking at the uranium companies where there used to be 100 in the space. It's like a handful, right? I mean, if you run a screen, you might find 10.
Yeah, about 10, yeah.
And these companies are up 100, 200%. A lot of these companies have run up tremendously from their lows, okay, because they've been down from, you know, like 80%, 90%. But right now, the fundamental landscape is just screaming for higher uranium prices. We have policies with Japan. They completely came offline with Fukushima. They're getting destroyed using other alternatives compared to nuclear. You have China, huge building nuclear facilities. So you have the fundamentals where demand's going to be huge and you're taking a ton of supply off the market. And the market is seeing that. And that's why you're seeing uranium prices drive higher. And there's still an opportunity to get a lot of these companies a lot cheaper. But I've been really into this for the last 6 months. I follow this industry very well and have close friends with CEOs for a lot of the uranium companies who have been bullish for a while and have been wrong. But for me, when you see these fundamental changes, it's a different landscape where I think uranium is a great sector to invest in, where if you buy a stock or two, if you want to be conservative, buy Cameco, hold it, close your eyes, open them in 5 years from now, you'll be a very happy person.
Now, let me talk about two things that have happened, which is interesting. So first of all, as the stocks came back and they roared back and there was really good things, we saw companies now do secondaries. Right, because obviously they need some cash injections. URRE did a secondary in, you know, the low twos.
Yes.
Did you see the news on Cameco late last week?
The new news that came out. They said one of their suppliers is going to cancel the contract.
Right. So this is a big supply. It's $200 million dollars a year. They have a contract out to 2028 TEPCO because of Fukushima. Mm-hmm. They're not using their of course, but they had a contract. Mm-hmm. They're trying to say that there was force majeure, that they're no longer allowed to be, you know, because the Japan government says you're not, you know, obviously you have a bad reactor, you're not going to be using uranium. But do we think that this is going to be, I mean, that's what I think, by the way, I think that's what was the reason that Cameco warned earlier, that they knew there was something down the pike, that there's going to be significant lower revenue, which is $220 million. I think they do about $1.4 billion dollars a year, and this is going to be $200 million a year cutting into their revenue stream.
Yeah.
But the question
is politics too.
It's politics, but the question is, you know, are they going to say, okay, we'll settle out for you, pay us up front, we'll close your deal, pay us half of it, we'll be done with it, or do you have any thoughts on how this is going to play out?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, this is what they're doing. Basically, they're saying that, you know, we want to restructure the contract. That's what that means, because we want to restructure the contract. And they're not going to mess around too much, right? Because they need uranium, they need supply. And if you screw the largest company in the world, who's going to ever do business with you again, right? So it's almost like, okay, we know these guys have a bad rep. So what they're trying to do is just basically try to lower their costs. They'll probably work out a deal with Cameco. And, you know, the news is out right now, which is, And I love this about stocks, guys, if you're listening in here. It's so important where, even with biotech stocks, when biotech stocks go to the FDA and say they're level two, phase two, phase three, and the FDA just shuts them down and says, we need more information, the stock usually declines by 60, 70%. Mm-hmm. You go on FinViz, you look at it, there's always a biotech stock every single day.
Every day. Every day.
So, you know, and they get crushed. And it's important to analyze that news because sometimes the FDA just acts, and I'm bringing the point back to chemical in a minute, but sometimes the FDA just, they need more information. So the stock will fall 70%. They have a pipeline of drugs that you're almost getting for free. The stock will fall so much because everybody runs to the exit at the same time that the stock sometimes trades below cash. And when that happens, it turns out to be a great buying opportunity because if they submit the information to the FDA and the FDA decides to approve it, that stock's going to double or triple from the prices it came down. So with Cameco right now, it's Cameco's pricing in that they're losing that $200 million forever. And they're not going to lose the whole entire thing. I mean, maybe they'll cut it down. Maybe it'll be 50 million. But that's what that whole – you got to look at it from a political standpoint. But if it's a company or a uranium producer that's that needs to buy uranium off the market from producers, and you go to large producers and say, screw you, we signed a contract, we're not going to honor it, be very, very careful. Because if you do that, who's going to do business with you in the future? So it's more political than anything.
And Cameco, by the way, from all of the uranium companies that are out there, I would say there's a few that like BHP Billiton and a few others that have uranium exposure and uranium mines. But Cameco is one of the best fundamentals overall, and it's a pure play. That's all they do is uranium.
It is the pure play.
Pure play.
It's a pure play producer in the industry. So there's other pure play uranium companies that aren't producers. I mean, you can look at Fission Uranium. You can look at a small company called Sky Harbor with a very small market cap that I like. I had the guy on my podcast recently. Right, great news. It benefited from higher prices. I'm not investing in the company. Just telling you a company you might want to look at. I'm not crazy about URE, UEC, Uranium Energy. I just went to a big dinner with them and had I met the Spencer Abraham, former Secretary of Energy, was there. What a great guy. He's on their board.
UEC.
You know, on UEC, and I went to a meeting on that, and he was like very, very optimistic. He said now with everybody coming in, the new people coming in the Trump administration, it's never been this, he's never been this optimistic on uranium in probably the last 10 years. And he was like a down to earth guy. I sat at the table with him and he was very, very funny. He's a great down to earth guy, but he was very optimistic. So UEC is another one to look at. But remember, this is going to be a driver of uranium prices. A lot of these companies have run up. So be patient. You know, if you're looking to get in and have exposure, you know, these are going to be very volatile stocks. If they run up, you know, the tendency is, oh, I missed it, let me try to get in. But wait, they're volatile. A lot of these things will come down. If the market comes down, you get a good opportunity to buy them.
Yeah, actually, just two questions, and we'll kind of give a quick wrap because I had two questions come in that I printed off because it would relate to you. And related to one is related to uranium. Jack C, he talks about, he bought my book, and thank you. He likes a lot. That was very nice of you, Jack. Thank you. Okay, here he says, a couple of episodes ago, you mentioned URRE. I looked, I like the outlook of uranium, especially after I saw Trump's energy-centric cabinet members. And then URRE dropped significantly earlier this year after the public offering of $2 a share, which we talked about. It dropped further when announced the plan to issue shares to retire debts and increase, which, by the way, is not a terrible thing. If you can issue some shares to retire debts, that's a good thing. You don't have the debt service anymore. And increase or improve the compensation incentive plan, blah, blah, blah. He talks about a few things. What's my take on it? I agree that when we look at URRE, it is not on, well, there's only a few we could say of the top companies in the sector. So, I mean, Cameco, again, is that one. URRE is a trading, it's beautiful for trading. It moves all over the place. I like URRE? I think the fundamentals, as I've mentioned before, are not stellar. Will it move if uranium moves? Yes. Will it probably, after all of this news is behind it, issuing some shares, getting some cash back on the books, retiring some debt, that's all good for the stock. You know, if in fact uranium prices do stabilize and move higher. So that was that. The other one came from Billy Medlin. He said, I want to thank me very much for my audio podcast. He says, you and your guests always sound very balanced from a volume standpoint. One suggestion. Here we go. One suggestion. Teach Curzio how to do that and how you do it. I don't know what that means exactly. I don't know what it means.
Maybe. No, it's not, you know, the balances are much better now. But a lot of times when I'm talking to people, they'll be in the field sometimes and my voice will be louder and I have them on cell phones. Because when it's Skype to Skype, it's perfect. You know, the sound's always perfect. Unfortunately, a lot of guys that have my podcast are never really at their desk. They're doing research and they're out in the field. And I kind of tell people, listen, as long as you can hear them, that's the most important thing. I'd rather you hear them than not do an interview because it might be a little low or whatever. And you know, you have one of the top guy in all of uranium on the podcast. I'd like to get him on for half an hour to give you guys that advantage. But sometimes, that's funny he said that. But also getting back to URE really quick here. Remember, guys, this is a junior miner company. What does that mean? It means that they're not a producer, right? So that's probably 90% of the publicly traded mining companies in the uranium space. They don't generate revenue. They don't generate profits. So they need to raise money at all times. And they want to do that the best possible time when their stock is higher. So the fact that you already waited for the stock to go up and they waited for this, you know, for you know, their stock to move higher, they did a big offering to have that. It's just like a biotech company, right? They need to raise cash all the time. And how they raise cash, they go out to investors based on the growth of your company, the news, the data. And if the data is positive, it's a lot easier to raise money. So it is a normal course of action. What they did is they, if you're going to raise more money, you got to do it at a bigger discount this way to get more people in. So that's why the stock took a hit where they said, let's raise a lot of money right now, which is a good thing. This way they have enough money to cover their expenses over the next 2 to 3 years.
Until they find something.
Well, they found something. They have deposits. It's a matter of them drilling it, how much it costs. Like right now, they can't drill. They can't drill. They can't make money on it right now on anything. No uranium producer can. But at 35, 40, they can. At 60, 70, which is the average price, then you see all these things coming back online. It's almost like in the oil industry with the Eagle Ford or the Bakken. I mean, drilling in the Bakken, there's hardly, I don't want to say hardly any drilling, but it's cut back significantly because it's one of the most expensive shale areas to drill in where you need probably 70, 75 oil. And we're at 50. They were still drilling over the past few years because they had their hedges in places. They locked in those hedges at much higher oil prices. When those hedges came off, I mean, obviously you're not going to create a product for $20 that you can only sell for $10. Doesn't make sense. So, you know, in the oil industry, that took place as well in the Bakken where you're not seeing as much drilling. With URE, you know, they have a great deposit. Fission uranium, Fission uranium, should take a look at one of the highest grade uranium you possibly have, just about. It's called Patterson Lake South. It's just, you know, at these prices, it just doesn't make sense. At 40, 50, 60, it makes incredible sense. And you'll see this company go into a $2, $3 billion market cap and be a monster if prices go up. So it's all based on prices if you buy this. If you're not bearish on uranium, or you're not bullish on uranium, don't buy uranium, especially junior miner stocks. But this, you know, again, they're trading vehicles. If you want to buy these things as an investment, you have to be pretty bullish on uranium that's going to go past 40, 50 bucks over the next couple of years.
Right. And that's a longer term hold. And that's why I said that URE and a few of these are good trading vehicles for, you know, quick trades. All right, we're going to have to end it here. I know Frank's in the field and he's got some appointments to go to. Real quickly, Frank, I know, you know, your launch of Curzio Research was extremely successful. I got emails in from people thanking me left and right, by the way, for your latest newsletters that you're putting out and your stock picks over on frankcurzio.com. And I know that I had a bunch of people like, what happened to the special deal? I'm like, I told you. I told you it was
coming back out. It's coming back out. It's going to be on our website too because we just launched it. We wanted to keep subscribers to a minimum because it's a small, high price newsletter. And, you know, we don't want too many people in there where the stock get driven a lot higher, which is the problem I had working for other publishing firms. And it's tough when you have subscribers and they're paying a lot of money and you're recommending a stock at 10. And, you know, your subscribers have different, you know, your listeners and your clients, everyone has different jobs. They're on vacation different days. They get the alerts different times. And you have a guy that will get alert, you know, that the stock I recommended maybe at 10 and it's 12.50, you know, like 2 months later. And again, it's all trading and algorithms. And I'd say 85% of the time those prices come down. But it's nice when you have a much smaller audience and more people can get into these situations before anybody else. But that offer's coming back online. We're going to take a few more subscribers soon.
Well, let us know because we'll make sure that everybody knows about that. The other thing is, why don't you have a text service where everybody can get the text immediately of what stock is being recommended?
We do, but with our business too, it's more, I'd like people to read everything about our stuff because it's not so much where we're traders, where we want people to hold these things for 18 to 24 months. And it's easy to just say, hey, here's a stock recommendation. But I like people to really read the reasons why we're buying this in the catalog. That's very, very important.
Well, it's also important because if you just, you know, just think through that for a second. If somebody gets just a stock from you and it drops or it goes up or whatever happens, you know, they buy at the top because everybody else is buying it, whatever. They don't understand the long term or the time period that the expectation is for this to hit. Then all of a sudden they become a very weak holder and just dump it and say, oh, that sucked. You know, versus,
So
you look at the perfect example is uranium stocks. I mean, if you bought them at the low, great. If you bought them in the middle, okay, fine. But they've been very volatile and you could have some problems. Anyway, Frank Curzio, frankcurzio.com over on Curzio Research. We'll put the information. We'll put all the stocks we talked about today as well in the show notes for this episode on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, as well as links right to Frank's website so you can find out more information. And don't forget, that he also has a terrific podcast each and every week that you can go to. So just look up Frank Curzio online. You could find how to get to this podcast. You can go to iTunes, look up Frank Curzio. He's usually, in terms of the ratings, he's right under me.
Yes, okay. Wall Street Unplugged. Yeah, I always say it. We always joke around. Hey, it's the second best podcast.
Anyway, all right. Hey, Frank, you go get him. Give us back your research the next time. We'll have you on soon.
Sounds great. Thanks, buddy.
All right. Thanks. Bye. And as I mentioned, we're going to have all the stocks mentioned on the website for the show notes for this show, episode number 495 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. By the way, episode number 500 is coming up. We're kind of thinking about some ideas on what to do. I don't know. Maybe you have some ideas on what we could do special for episode number 500. You could always write to me. Just go over to the website, click on the Ask Andrew button. And just simply put in your question there. It gets right to me, right to my desktop, right to my email. So just do that anytime you want to communicate, ask a question that we can have on the show. And actually, I got a dozen maybe questions here that have been piling up that we'll try to answer on the next episode. Make sure to listen to all the things that we talk about each and every week. Of course, you can find us on iTunes and on Google Play and Stitcher and all that. Also, DH Unplugged each and every week. Until next week, I want to thank you. Hopefully, it's going to be an exciting Super Bowl tonight. I'll see you soon. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.